Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to our call today. This is John Patika Jr. with the Patika Wealth Management Group. And I'm accompanied here with my partner and father, John Patika Sr. And we've got a lot to unpack today politically. And there was a big vote yesterday in the House, and our guest speaker here will talk more about that in a second. He's actually our third John on the call. We got three Johns. And John Savercool serves as our senior lobbyist here at UBS, and he helps direct the lobbying, firm's lobbying, political policy advocacy efforts here at the federal level, and manages a staff over in Washington to help support this mission. John's a 23-year veteran at Capitol Hill and began his career with U.S. Congressman Matt Oxley, a Republican from Ohio and the former chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. And then he spent 17 years with Congressman Phil Graham out of Texas, and who won the election in U.S. Senate in 1984, and also worked as an interim chief of staff for U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson in 1993. So, like I said, we got a lot to go over today, and welcome to the call, John.
Hey, John.
Thanks for having me on the call.
Perfect timing. Debt ceiling vote last night. Maybe you can just run it through in the process here.
You know, the debt ceiling crisis, which has now been before us for the last couple of weeks, was resolved to a certain extent through the passage of the bill in the House last evening. It was an overwhelming bipartisan vote, which reflects well for, I think, what will happen in the Senate tomorrow or this weekend. So the bill has passed the House. The Senate is now considering it. The challenge with the Senate is that in the Senate, anyone can offer an amendment to the bill, and the amendment has to be considered. So that means that a certain amount of time has to be assigned to a debate on an amendment and then a vote. So senators who oppose the agreement will offer different amendments to it, and that will stretch the process out a little bit. So we won't have an immediate vote like we had in the House. The House is able just to vote whenever it wants to, really. The Senate has to wait until all these amendments are dispensed with. And, you know, I suspect that that will happen sometime over the next couple of days. The X date, the day for default, is June the 5th. So Congress just has to beat that deadline. And I think it will. I think we'll see a deal Friday night or over the weekend. The Senate will stay in session all night over the weekend until it gets this deal done. So it's on a good path for passage, and very soon this debt ceiling crisis, I think, will be behind us.
John, does it take 60 votes? Is that one of those?
It does, yes. In the Senate, everything takes 60 votes except for some nominations. So this will require 60 votes. There are 51 Democrats, so 49 Republicans. And, you know, the compromise has to be bipartisan for it to get 60 votes. That was always the dynamic here. And that's why the bill is significantly scaled back from what the House passed a month or a month and a half ago. So this is a scaled back bill. It'll certainly get more than 60 votes. It'll get upwards of probably 80 votes in the Senate. So it will easily clear the 60 vote threshold. You know, the leaders all support this, the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate, the Republican leaders in the House and Senate, and then President Biden. So most members will follow those leads and will support the agreement.
So that's 2 years. Am I understanding that this won't have to come up again next year? It's 2 years?
Yeah, that's right. The date for the next debt ceiling extension is in the agreement as supposed to be January of 2025. But the reality is that that will likely be pushed back a little bit because January 2025 is just a date. The Treasury can probably go a little further than that. So sometime in the first half of 2025, there will be another debt ceiling debate. So that's the good news from the perspective of investors and our clients. To the extent that Washington affects the markets, there shouldn't be any kind of debt ceiling nervousness or contention until at least the first half of 2025. And also, just to mention another issue, because of that, there probably won't be any changes to the tax code between now and sometime 2025 or 2026. So the two issues that, in our view, create a lot of nervousness among investors, tax rates, higher tax rates, and debt ceiling contention and market reaction to that, they'll be off the table for almost 2 years, which will be a nice period of peace for all of us.
Now, we talked yesterday a little bit. There's another, the appropriations process is coming up, and there's, you know, a lot of contention there that you could actually have a different kind of shutdown. Maybe you can go through that. I don't think people are ready for that.
Yeah, so every year there is a process by which the Congress has to approve of government funding for the new fiscal year. And the new fiscal year begins on October 1st. So right now we are in fiscal year 2023. On October 1, we will be in fiscal year 2024. All of the government agencies will need to have new funding to be able to operate in the new year. And this is always a pretty contentious process. It's become easier over the years because Congress just spends a lot of money and they don't really debate reductions in spending. So whatever members want, they just throw in the funding bill and it's generally approved. But this year, with caps on federal spending included in the deal that was struck on the debt ceiling extension, there'll be caps on what members can spend. So there'll be competition for a lot of programs and a lot of agencies under a capped budget from last year. So there won't be an increase in federal spending from last year to this year. Over the last 5 or 6 years, federal spending has grown by about 10%. So now we're in a position where there'll be no growth in federal spending, and defense and veterans affairs have actually been given a very slight increase. So the fight will be over domestic programs affecting people, whether it's community development, housing, education, healthcare, transportation. Those are programs that will all likely see some cuts, and there'll be a lot of competition among lawmakers to try to fund those at levels that they think are acceptable. There'd be a big fight about that. And so that could, and I think it's likely, that there'll be a showdown again, a very similar showdown, as we get toward October 1. But the ramifications will be that the government might be shut down if a bill is not approved by October 1. There won't be the threat of a default, which is a far greater risk to all of us than a government shutdown. A government shutdown would primarily affect paychecks of government employees, would affect a lot of funding that the government makes. It wouldn't be a good thing, but it wouldn't be catastrophic like a default would be. And again, that agreement will have to be done by the early fall, or we will see a government shutdown. We've seen government shutdowns in the past, and we've seen them last a couple weeks. And again, they are problematic, but they're not catastrophic like a default would have been.
Well, how would you see that playing out with your experience? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you see that playing out? I mean, is this different with the little margin that they have in the House? I mean, is that going to be a big deal?
So there will be a fight because, you know, the House is controlled by Republicans. Democrats control the Senate. Republicans will be a little more likely to want to cut spending. Democrats will be more resistant to it. So, yeah, there will be a lot of fights. A lot of these programs that have been cut are programs that seem to be more important to Democrats than Republicans. There, a lot of times, there's supplemental funding from the government to support local spending. For instance, you know, education is primarily funded by local tax bases, you know, local governments, as is housing and transportation. And so these supplemental federal funds are likely to be pared back, and Democrats won't like that. So there will be a fight. And again, there will probably be a showdown as we get closer to October 1.
Okay. We'll have you on again around that time, I think, and we'll see how that's playing out. Just two quick questions before I wanted to switch to 2024 politics. The U.S.-China relations, how do you see this playing out, John?
Well, U.S.-China relations, and there's so many issues involved in that relationship. A couple of weeks ago, I counted up all of the issues where the U.S. and China have kind of acted badly toward each other. There's been a little fight. There's been contention. They've had a war of words. I counted 34 issues. And, you know, I think if I had, in my relationship with my wife, if I had 34 serious issues to fight about, I wouldn't have a wife. So it's a serious relationship, and it's seriously threatened by a lot of disagreements. And at the core of that is that the U.S. has the number one economy, the number one military. We have had those for a long time. China would one economy and the number one military, and are working hard to surpass the U.S. So naturally, there is friction in the relationship as both want to best the other to become number one. So there's going to be tension in this relationship for a long time. There have been more hearings in Congress on the U.S.-China relationship than any other issue this year. And the interest is bipartisan. And there aren't really a lot of disagreements between Republicans and Democrats about what our policy should be as it relates to China. And that policy is to win and not to cede the number one position to China. So whether it's Trump or Biden or DeSantis or anyone else in the race, the policy on China, I think, will continue. The U.S. policy on China will continue to be tough. The China policy toward the U.S. will continue to be tough. And this will be an issue that will be around for a long time, certainly well beyond my working days. And I think we'll probably have a cooler or cold war with China for some time until something gives. And so it's up to the U.S. and it's up to China to somehow manage this relationship in a way that the war of words and the finger pointing back and forth doesn't turn into anything more serious.
John, artificial intelligence, AI, they're having hearings on that. Any insight to that?
There's a lot of interest in Congress over AI issues. At the same time, there's a lot of ignorance in Congress about AI issues. There's a lot of issues about Congress on broad technology issues. Many members of Congress don't even use a computer, so they don't really know what the issues are. Now, some do, and some are very smart on what the path forward is, but most are not. And I don't think Congress is close to enacting any kind of regulation surrounding artificial intelligence. It's more of an exercise to have hearings, to learn more, to hear from experts, to show that Congress is engaged and they're thinking about this. I think this is probably an issue of greater urgency than Congress thinks right now. But remember, we had the same urgency years ago when all of a sudden people decided that technology needed to be subject to greater regulation. And even today, we don't really have a lot of regulatory or legal constraints around technology. So I'm not certain that Congress will act in any way. There may be little things that the Biden administration does and that the next administration does if it's not the Biden administration. For the most part, this is just an exercise of gathering more information and not an exercise that will result in any new laws or regulations anytime soon.
Oh, good. Thanks, John. Let's move to the presidential politics. I know the media is already out of breath every time you switch the channels on, and you know, this is pretty early. And I remember in the past, just top of my head, you know, Rudy Giuliani was winning, Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Bernie Sanders, they won Iowa. I can go on, but, you know, what are your thoughts? I know it's early, but tell me what you think. You've been around this a long time.
Well, it is very early, and I think that people should recognize that and recognize the potential for other things happening that maybe today we're just not thinking of. If the election was held tomorrow, you know, Trump would win the Republican primary based on the polling, which is probably more accurate than not, especially if you're up by 20 or 30 points. It doesn't matter whether it's 20 or 30, you're still going to win. But the election's going to be held much later. And in particular, on the Republican side, there won't be primary elections until early next year. So there are still 6 or 7 months before any contest occur that will determine who the nominee is. I think on the Republican side, there are a lot of candidates already in. There will be other candidates joining the fray in the next few weeks. Mike Pence and Chris Christie will probably get in. DeSantis is now in. DeSantis had a little stumble before he got in. But I think that could be overlooked among voters if, in fact, DeSantis does better. I mean, after all, he does have a record in Florida that is compelling, and it will make him, in my view, a formidable candidate. In my view, there is a clear market on the Republican side for a candidate other than Trump. Most Republicans are comfortable with Trump in one way or the other, but most Republicans also would rather see a different person emerge as a candidate and be the nominee for the party. A lot of people don't have a problem with the Trump policies. They like many of his policies, but they don't like the character. So a lot of people, I think, are looking for someone other than Trump. So one of the other candidates, whether it's DeSantis or Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or Mike Pence, are going to have to emerge as the alternative to Trump. And that's what will evolve over the next several months. The big catalyst will be the debates. The first debate, I think, is on the last day of August. That debate will be important, although it will still be during vacation time, so it may not be heavily watched, but the debates later in the fall and the winter will help kind of narrow the field so that it'll likely be Trump and probably one other person. DeSantis seems to have the credentials to be that one guy, but, you know, you never know. People stumble all the time. As you indicated, John, there were several front runners in the past couple races who just fizzled as the race went on. So you could see someone else step up and take that position. And yeah, I think it's possible that Trump could be knocked off and there could be another Republican nominee. I think it's also possible that Joe Biden may not run. And, you know, he is going to be probably facing a recession at some point. His son may be subject to more legal and public scrutiny that will further damage the Biden brand. The president's approval ratings are very, very low, and they seem to be stubbornly low. They don't kind of go up and down with events. They're just kind of stuck at a high 30% that has kind of kept him at a very low level. So I don't know. I mean, at age 80, and, you know, does he, you know, when he looks at polls showing that a majority of people in his own party don't want him to run, does he reconsider? And if Biden doesn't run, does Trump reconsider? You know, he wants revenge against the guy who beat him. He's facing his own legal issues. He has six pending legal challenges before him that are all going to consume a lot of his dollars in defending himself. He lost one issue a couple weeks ago where he was convicted of sexual abuse and defamation, had to pay a $5 million fine. At what point does his wallet become lighter? At what point does his business become less profitable where he may want to turn to them rather than a presidential run? I don't know. I'm not speculating based on intelligence I have from either campaign, but my gut tells me that there are good reasons why these two may not want to be candidates when election time comes around. But for the purpose of today and for the foreseeable future, we have to assume that both will be candidates. They are both declared, and they both lead in their respective parties. So as of today, they would most likely be the nominee, although, again, a million things can happen between now and the election, and hundreds of thousands of things will happen.
Well, they've talked about Jamie Dimon, the governor of California. Is there any chance that one of those two will just step in, or are they giving him professional courtesy and staying out of the way?
I think it's courtesy now. It's a uncomfortable thing for people in the president's party to challenge him. Hasn't been very successful in the past. So I don't think any Democrats will step up, or any major Democrats will step up and challenge Biden as long as he's committed to the race. Now, if he doesn't run, you could see Kamala Harris decide to run. Biden has been trying to tout her more lately and trying to give her more exposure, giving her different tasks. Some of the assignments that she drew early in the administration were legitimately hard assignments, but she just didn't make a mark in trying to work on those things. But again, you know, her approval ratings are even lower than Biden. So I think it would be tough for Democrats to put together various candidates at a late date. The California governor Newsom would probably run. Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary, would probably run. There's probably a couple of senators who would run, but no one who would be a slam dunk nominee. I think it would be very competitive. And if it's late, then it really puts them behind in terms of fundraising and doing things that they would want to do to set themselves up for a successful run.
How about let's turn to the Senate map? You've talked about that in the past, where the Republicans have a number advantage in this cycle. Maybe talk to that and then talk about the recruiting of top-tier candidates, how that's going in the states, John.
Yeah, so no one should overlook the House and Senate as part of the 2024 elections either. They're very important. As we all know, the Republicans have a very narrow majority in the House. Democrats have a very narrow majority in the Senate. Those could easily be flipped or maintained in next year's election. In fact, in the Senate, Democrats have a 51-49 majority. Every 2 years, about a third of the Senate is up for reelection. So about 33 members are up for reelection. Most states will not be competitive. They're reliably Republican or reliably Democratic. But of the competitive seats, of which there are about six or seven, most are states where there are Democratic incumbents. And in fact, most of these states, Trump won pretty big in 2020. So you would think that Republicans would have a good shot at winning those seats. And those seats would be states like Ohio, where there's a longtime Democratic senator, fairly liberal guy in an increasingly Republican state. It includes Montana, which is overwhelmingly Republican. There is a moderate Democrat in that seat. He's been there a couple terms. He's popular, but as the state becomes more conservative, he could be knocked out. In West Virginia, a strong Republican state, Democrat Senator Joe Manchin may face a very uphill battle. The Republicans were able to recruit the governor of the state, Governor Justice, and he will be a very strong candidate. So, and there are a couple of other states where Republicans have a chance. So the map favors Republicans. The number of seats up favors Republicans. And it's, you know, there's a good chance that Republicans will have a majority. I think they will win the West Virginia seat. I think that's a given. My sense is that Senator Joe Manchin may retire from the Senate. So I think that would be one opening, and that would put the Senate at 50-50. And that could be a Republican majority if a Republican wins the presidency. So you could see a Republican majority in the Senate. You could also see a Democratic majority in the House. It's just too close right now to know, but clearly the parties are hoping for a sweep. Unified government is something that Democrats and Republicans really want. If it's a divided government as it is today, we're going to have some of these policies and some of these bills that are contentious, like the debt ceiling. Not that this was altogether bad. If you like cuts in federal spending, if you like deficit reduction, if you're tired of our debt and deficit, the recent agreement was good, and that was produced by a bipartisan divided government. But, you know, there were costs to it. I mean, people were nervous around a potential default. It's a nervous time for investors who are worried about the consequences of such a fight. So we'll see what happens. But right now, I would predict that the Senate will probably win the majority in the Senate. In the House, it'll probably stay the same. But much depends on who the nominees for the parties are and how that race goes. A lot of people vote based on who they vote for president. So whoever wins the presidencies will have an advantage in both the House and the Senate in picking up seats in those chambers.
Well, thanks. It's really all I have, but what else? Any other closing comments that you might have for us?
Well, I think we kind of covered what's likely to happen. We got, you know, one other thing that I would point to people is no activity on the tax front. So if you're concerned about your tax rates or the state tax or retirement planning tools, nothing will change. So no worries out of Washington over those issues. I think a big issue to watch this year will be funding over Ukraine. Ukraine is about, we're told they're about to enter an offensive. That has to be successful for Ukraine to keep up very high support in the Congress. Remember, all the new funding initiatives that come out, there will be another attempt to add a lot of money to help Ukraine, but Republicans will insist on that being offset by reductions in other federal spending. So if the president wants to spend $50 billion on Ukraine, he's got to find $50 billion to offset that with. That will be a big deal in the House. And I think another thing to watch is whether Kevin McCarthy will remain a speaker. Any one Republican House member can call for a vote at any time on whether to keep him or not. And there are a lot of Freedom Caucus members unhappy about the debt ceiling agreement. I don't think it did enough to pare back the deficit. They could recall him, and we could have a new speaker, or certainly if he's still in office, he will play a hard bargain with offsets on Ukraine spending and on offsets and on keeping the deal as part of the government funding bill. So this deal will be tested, and it relates to McCarthy's status as speaker, and that could be a big issue as we move forward over the next couple of weeks and months.
All right, great. I know we're running out of time here, John, so we appreciate you coming on and spending a few minutes with us today to let us know what's going on in your world. And for anyone listening today, you know, John and his team do have a very nice newsletter that comes out weekly called the Washington Weekly. And if anybody would like to subscribe to that, feel free to reach out to us and we'll get you on that newsletter list. So once again, thank you again, John, and hope everyone has a great rest of the week.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you.